Grand Canyon University makes earning your degree possible with over 130 academic programs for traditional campus students, with more than 80 bachelor's programs offered online. GCU provides you with the personal support you need, from complimentary unofficial transcript evaluations within 24 business hours to scholarships, academic support, and your GCU graduation team led by your own university counselor. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
At Grainger, we're for the ones who specialize in saving the day and for the ones who've mastered the art of keeping business moving. We offer industrial-grade supplies for every industry, with same-day pickup and next-day delivery on most orders, all backed by real people ready to help, so you can get the right answers and products right when you need them. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello and welcome to the History of Japan podcast, episode 483, Japan, the Beautiful, the Ambiguous, part 2. In many respects, part of what was exciting for me about this miniseries was the chance to talk about an intriguing generational difference. Kawabata Yasunari was born in 1899 in, depending on how you parse it, either the second or third generation of the new Meiji Imperial State. He was born into an era of rising imperial tides and of a renewed sense of patriotism and passion for things Japanese, a fact that, I suspect, informed somewhat his interest in a particularly Japanese literature. Oe Kenzaburo, on the other hand, was born on January 31st, 1935, which meant that he came of age in a very different Japan. His formative years were defined not by a triumphant rise to the heights of the great powers, but by crushing defeat. Oe was born into a poor family, the fifth of seven children of Oe Kotare and Oe Koseki. Alongside Kenzaburo, the family had three more sons and three more daughters. The family was from Ose, a village that's now a part of Uchiko Township in Ehime Prefecture on the northwest coast of the island of Shikoku. Ehime, particularly in the early 20th century, was one of the more rural areas of Japan, and Ose was one of the more rural parts of Ehime. The Oe family had been samurai once upon a time, but had fallen on hard times, in part because of the poverty of the region, and in part because Ehime, the former Matsuyama domain, had been staunchly pro-shogunate at the tail end of the feudal era and had suffered for its opposition to what became the new imperial government. Kenzaburo's father Kotare actually made his living stripping bark from trees to be sold for various commercial purposes, so not exactly the kind of job one gets rich doing. Still, Oe Kenzaburo was able, thanks to the advent of universal education in Japan, to at least go to school, though it was far from a smooth educational experience, because he entered elementary school at the age of 6, the same year the Pacific War began. Despite that, his education was a fairly standard one for the time, working his way through the city's elementary, middle, and high schools. The only remarkable thing was that in his second of 3 years in high school, he transferred to the higher quality public school in the far larger town of Matsuyama, the prefectural capital. Honestly, it's pretty neat to see a Nobel laureate in literature produced by a public education system in a rural area. This is why, folks, you invest in education. Apparently, young Kenzaburo developed an interest in storytelling from a young age, driven primarily by his grandmother, who regaled him with tales of her own youth during the very earliest days of Imperial Japan, when Ehime was home to a fairly large anti-government uprising in 1872, alongside nine other prefectures, opposed to the then-brand-new Universal Conscription Law. It's always tempting to read into an author's future from these childhood anecdotes, and while it's probably good sense to resist the impulse, one can't help but wonder if Oe Kenzaburo's own rebellious streak, politically speaking, grew out of those childhood stories. It's editorializing, certainly, but it makes for a good story, and I feel like he, of all people, would appreciate that. The formative experience of his childhood, he later said, was of course the shocking announcement in August of 1945 that Japan had lost the Second World War. Like all school children, Oe had been subjected to rigorous classes in ethics that were largely exercises in pro-government propaganda. He later recalled they were drilled to respond to questions like, "What if the emperor commanded you to die?" with things like, "Of course I would cut open my belly." Oe would later recall the shocking events of August 15, 1945, when Emperor Hirohito, for the first time, took to the airwaves and read the decision to surrender in his own voice. He would say, quote, "The strange and disappointing fact was that the emperor spoke in a human voice, like any ordinary man. Though we couldn't understand the speech, we heard his voice. One of my friends could even imitate it clearly. We surrounded him, a boy in soiled shorts who spoke in the emperor's voice, and laughed. Our laughter echoed in the summer morning stillness and disappeared into the clear, high sky. An instant later, anxiety tumbled out of the heavens and seized us impious children. We stared at one another in silence." Much of his later career was an attempt to grapple with the void left by defeat, the collapse of what had been absolute moral clarity in the righteousness of the imperial cause, and the need to figure out what belonged there instead. Defeat, which came for those of you counting along when Oe was 10 years old, also meant the second half of his pre-university education took place not under the old regime, but under the American occupation. Ethics, as a subject, was discarded in favor of programs to study the new constitution and the meaning of democracy. And the fact that Oe came of age during that time explains a lot about why so much of his career is bound up so directly with Japan's own politics. He would, for the rest of his life, be a fierce defender of and believer in the post-war constitution. In her work on Oe's early years, Sakurai Emiko illustrates this nicely by contrasting Oe with Mishima Yukio, who was born just over 10 years before Oe on January 14, 1925, and who thus grew up entirely under the pre-war militarist regime. And that's one way to explain the right-wing politics which defined Mishima's life. Initially, Oe wanted to become a scientist before being discouraged by his teachers. However, he was also always interested in literature, particularly poetry. He's actually from the same part of Japan as the great haiku poet and, of course, baseball legend Masaoka Shiki, and the Matsuyama High School he transferred to was the same one Masaoka had graduated from decades earlier. Oe's own brother would become a poet focused on traditional Japanese poetry, and later in life, Oe would credit his own sense of speech and rhythm in his writing to his youth composing waka poetry. With Masaoka as his gateway, so to speak, Oe then found his way to more modern Japanese poets like Tominaga Taro and Nakahara Chuya, and from them to French and English poetry. He was actually a particular fan of W.H. Auden, the British poet whom Kawabata Yasunari would beat out for a Nobel Prize in 1968. In literature, Oe's childhood favorite was apparently a copy of Huckleberry Finn he read during the occupation years. This is, of course, one of the canonical works of American literature. In particular, Oe was apparently deeply moved by Huck Finn's decision in the pre-Civil War South to partner with Jim, a runaway slave, rather than turning him in to the authorities. For a young man who'd been raised to view authority and the obedience thereto as an absolute good, the decision to ignore authority in favor of doing what was right was moving indeed. He would later write an article on American literature where he would hold up Huckleberry Finn as the archetype of an American-style independent-minded hero. After graduating from high school, Oe would take the competitive entrance exams for Tokyo University, which, after 1945, lost the Imperial from its name, and was admitted. Unlike Kawabata, he did not pursue Japanese literature as a subject, but instead focused on French. He developed a particular interest in Francoise Rabelais, a Renaissance-era writer and satirist, and a favorite of his mentor at university, Watanabe Kazuo. And I should note, this is another interesting difference between Oe's literary background and Kawabata's. Kawabata Yasunari was certainly interested in Western ideas. His thinking was heavily influenced by the modernist movement, as we discussed last week, but he always viewed himself as primarily a Japanese writer, drawing from a Japanese, or broader, Oriental, again his words, tradition, though that tradition was very fuzzily defined. Oe's literary background and his interests were more self-consciously international. In addition to the writers already mentioned, he was apparently also a big fan of Dostoevsky in particular, calling the great Russian writer's work a cure for his own anxieties and uncertainties. While still in university, Oe began to rise to new heights of literary fame, publishing a series of short stories during the final 2 years of his college education. In 1957, as a senior, he developed a national following when one of his short stories, Shisha no Ogori, or Proud Are the Dead, was shortlisted for the coveted Akutagawa Prize in Literature, losing out narrowly to Kai Koen, 5 years his senior, and author of Haraka no Ousama, or The Naked Emperor. Someone this young, even being nominated, obviously drew a lot of attention Oe's way, even more so when, the very next year, another one of his stories, Shiku, won the prize. From there, Oe's career took on a meteoric upward trajectory, and the rest, as they say, is history. However, I don't think we can bring up the particular story, Shiku, without some mention of what it's actually about. We've actually talked about it before, way back in our episodes on Black History in Japan, episode 347 to be specific. The tale is based very loosely on a story Oe was told by his teachers in school about a Black American aviator being shot down in rural Japan during World War II. In his telling of the tale, Oe is clearly attempting to make a point about the complexity of race as it relates to American-Japanese relations, for example by having some of the villagers in the story discuss what they had heard about race relations and Jim Crow discrimination in American life. But he also slips into some pretty questionable depictions of the Black pilot, particularly depicting him as obsessed with sex and as sexually predatory. I'd call those questionable choices at best, and to my knowledge, Oe himself never really grappled with the portrayal later in his career, and I do just want to note this because it is out there about his work. Before we get into Oe's writing, there's one other aspect of his life that I also want to highlight. Oe was graduating from college in 1958, which put him on the older edge of the so-called Anpo generation, the generation of young students who grew up in the shadow of the Second World War and who spearheaded the protests against the renewal of the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty in 1960. Those protests, in turn, were one of the defining moments of post-war Japan politically. They represented a sort of political perfect storm. Prime Minister Kishi Nobusuke's decision to renew and revise the security treaty with the United States, which he thought would be largely uncontroversial, turned out to, well, not be. Concerns about being tied to the United States in the Cold War, and thus becoming a target for the Soviet Union, combined with a sense of anger at Kishi's autocratic handling of dissent around the treaty, forcing its ratification through the Diet with minimal debate, to produce massive protest. The result was a truly incredible series of street protests culminating in a literal battle over the gates of the Diet between protesters and police, in which one of the protesters was killed. Oe was part of a group of left-wing students who had opposed the treaty from the jump. As we've discussed before, much of the eventual opposition to the treaty and the bulk of the protesters came to the cause driven more than anything by Prime Minister Kishi's handling of the issue, which was perceived as undemocratic and authoritarian, a sensitive issue given the newness of Japan's own post-war democracy. Oe, however, was not one of those later comers who was concerned more with how Kishida was doing things than what he was doing. He opposed the treaty from the jump. Oe and a lot of other students were firmly in the camp of Japan's political left and was an opponent of the security treaty on ideological grounds. And he was not particularly unusual among students of his generation in this. In the 50s, university campuses, dominated by students who grew up during a reaction to the militant rightism of the 40s, were hotbeds of political leftism. Sidney Brown, who was a research fellow at Tokyo University at the same time Oe was there, relates one anecdote from the time Oe was in school. He recalled a student strike held to protest a British hydrogen bomb test that was so effective that while it was going on, the massive campus in the heart of downtown Tokyo was virtually emptied of its thousands of students. Given the climate of activism on campus, it's not surprising that Oe was involved in it during and after his time in school. However, this was not some school time fixation of Oe's that was left behind as he grew up. He would remain a staunch political leftist throughout his life, and in many ways a voice of left-wing dissent in a society that, as he grew older, was increasingly dominated by the center and right. For example, Oe was a constant critic of the system of textbook controls imposed by the education ministry in the mid-1950s to centralize control over how Japanese history was taught in schools. In one interview given to the New York Times in the 1990s, he described the textbooks approved by the government and their approved version of history as, quote, watering down the infliction of damage on other nations and justifying Japan's invasion and colonial rule. He also very directly attacked the Japanese extreme right, and especially the fascist movements of the Uyoku Dantai. If you don't know that term, it essentially refers to ultra-right societies in the post-war period. For example, in 1961, he produced two short stories based on Otoya Yamaguchi, the right-wing teenage fanatic who, in the summer of 1960, had stabbed the Socialist Party chairman Asanuma Inajiro to death in the middle of a televised debate. Oe's story portrays its protagonist, based pretty clearly on Yamaguchi, who committed suicide in his prison cell shortly after the murder, as the product not of true patriotism, but of socially alienated teenage masculinity. The protagonist's story starts off almost as a teen comedy, where he's just a maladjusted boy making dick jokes with his friends. The difference is that he discovers meaning not in the typical teen movie sense of being yourself and loving your friends and all that stuff, but in a street battle where he is swept up in a conflict between left-wing students and right-wing counter-protesters. He joins the ultra-right and assassinates a politician based on Asanuma, driven by both a desire to find certainty in the confusion of his life, and by increasingly mad visions of the emperor as an idealized godlike figure who begins to appear to him in his dreams and then his waking life. The two chapters of this story, entitled 17 and The Death of a Political Youth, had to be withdrawn from publication because of the controversy surrounding them. The magazine that ran them, Bungakai, had to issue a retraction after it was bombarded with threats from right-wing groups, and Oe, fearing for the magazine staff's safety and his own and his family's, agreed to withdraw the story from circulation. Also telling of Oe's politics is his view of the United States, a relationship summed up well by the word ambiguity, which we are going to come back to later in this episode. The US, of course, was responsible for the ultimate destruction of Japan's wartime regime, unleashing the freedom that so defined Oe's life and career. On the other hand, I think it is fair to characterize American policy towards Japan as pretty cynical, championing freedom of the press while also banning stories during the occupation that spoke about the atomic bombs, championing self-determination in Asia while also maintaining Okinawa as a U.S.-controlled territory for military bases until 1972. In his essay on Oe's views of the United States, Dr. Sidney Brown calls him a, quote, friendly critic of America, and I think that's a pretty good way to frame it. Oe was not, I think it is clear, anti-American in his politics, and there was much he admired in American ideals around personal independence, responsibility, and freedom. But he was also deeply put off, to say the least, by the substantial gap between the lofty ideals espoused publicly by the US and its more self-serving policies overseas, in Asia and elsewhere, and to be fair, he was far from alone in that. All told, where Kawabata Yasunari attempted to be studiously apolitical, though how successful he was at that is, to say the least, debatable, Oe had no such pretensions. He was very much a child of the Japanese left, including a stint as a college student in the All Japan League of Student Self-Governing Associations, or the Zengakuren, and joining the 1960 Anpo protests themselves. Later in the 60s, he was actively involved in everything from the anti-Vietnam War citizens group known as Beiheiren to the nuclear disarmament movement to the movement to demand a reversion of Okinawa to Japanese sovereignty. Now, okay, you might be wondering, this is all well and good, but why does it matter for the story of Oe Kenzaburo as a writer? Well, because just as Kawabata Yasunari's studiously apolitical politics informed his work for good and ill, Oe's overt embrace of left-wing politics and the politics of the so-called Anpo generation informed his. Obviously, 17 and Death of a Political Youth represent examples of this, given how directly they grapple with the nature of right-wing politics in Japan. But even his less well-regarded work deals with similar themes, and here I'm thinking of Oe's first novel, Warewa no Seidai, or Our Generation, which came out in 1958 and which was widely panned when it did. The novel is set in the aftermath of the occupation and involves a sort of strange love triangle between Yasuo, a young Japanese man who serves as a stand-in for Oe and the other male youth of his generation, Wilson, an American of unidentified occupation living in the country, and Yoriko, a sex worker with whom Yasuo has a relationship that slowly fades in favor of her relationship with Wilson. The novel was, as already established, not terribly popular when it came out, largely because so much of it revolves around sex, and because Oe wrote the sex scenes extremely graphically and with a lot of emphasis on sweatiness and fluids, let's call it. And in the interest of the clean tag I put on this podcast almost 10 years ago, that's all I'm going to say about that, except to say that I have read bits of the scenes in question, and I would call them extra, as the youth say. This was not, however, Oe's attempt to write smut. If it was, it would be pretty bad, because the whole plot is decidedly not very sexy for something that revolves so much around sex. Instead, it's largely about Yasuo's insecurities, as personified by his loss of his primary sexual partner to Wilson, and how those insecurities are wrapped up in his own insecurities about being Japanese. After all, Yasuo wonders, what does his generation have to look forward to? They can no longer be heroes in the mold of World War II-era soldiers, and their country has been forced into a subservient role by America, as personified by Wilson and Yoriko's relationship. Oe was pretty clearly attempting to make a point about the nature of post-war Japanese identity, the title itself, Our Generation, being a bit of a giveaway there. As he'd write in a later essay, quote, "The spiritual preoccupation of Japanese youth generally is to wish for exile, for escape from Japan. In fact, many young Japanese already live as exiles within Japan. For instance, young Japanese have rejected Japanese films, and they watch foreign films as if they were their own. They come out of the movie theater with the walk and facial expression of foreigners, reveling in these few moments of escape from their identity as Japanese. What's more, they try to prolong these moments of bliss as non-Japanese. On the Ginza, as well as the summer resorts such as Karuizawa and Kamakura, the fad to find ways not to be Japanese has become rampant." Yasuo's whole struggle was an attempt to grapple with that desire to not be Japanese. Indeed, the way he ultimately escapes his doubts is by getting a scholarship to move to France. Interestingly, like many other members of the Anpo generation, by the late 60s, Oe's work would move away from themes concerning the Japanese left directly, and into more of a focus on individualism and self-actualization, more existentialist than overtly left-wing political. In this too, his trajectory mirrored many other members of the Anpo generation, who became increasingly disillusioned with traditional left-wing movements. But for Oe, there was one other, specifically personal catalyst. In February of 1960, Oe married Itami Yukari, daughter of the early Japanese director and screenwriter Itami Mansaku, and sister of Itami Juzo, whose work as a director we've previously discussed on this podcast. The two would eventually have three children, but one of these three is of particular relevance to Oe Kenzaburo's literary career. Their eldest child, a son named Hikari, was born in 1963 with a serious condition called brain herniation, essentially when pressure from the skull pushes the brain in ways it is not supposed to be pushed. The operation to relieve said pressure left Hikari with brain damage that led both to visual impairments and very serious developmental delays. Grappling with what it would mean to raise Hikari became a serious theme of Oe's later work, most notably his 1964 book, A Personal Matter, or Kojin Teki na Kaiken. He would return to this theme several more times over the course of his career, and ultimately father and son were able to find some pretty beautiful common ground together. Hikari's parents would find, you see, that their son was soothed by music, and so would play it for him on the regular. And eventually, though language always remained a challenge for him, Hikari would become a composer himself. Today he's quite highly regarded as one, and apparently both father and son would spend a great deal of time together, each creating in their own ways. Still, getting there took time. Initially, Oe Kenzaburo would say he felt overwhelmed by the challenge of raising a son like Hikari, and would essentially flee his family for a time after the boy's birth by taking a journalism job on short notice and temporarily abandoning his writing career. This too, however, proved to be a fortuitous moment. He was assigned to cover an anti-nuclear conference in Hiroshima, and over the course of his time there, was profoundly impressed by the stories of the atomic bomb survivors he met. In particular, Oe would later recall a discussion with Dr. Shigeto Fumio, himself an atomic bomb survivor who had devoted his life to treating those who had also survived the blasts. Shigeto, Oe later recalled, was a man of supreme compassion who told him that, quote, "If there are wounded people, if they are in pain, we must do something for them, try to cure them, even if we seem to have no method." The experience made a deep impression on Oe, both personally, it steeled him to step up and be a father to his son through difficult times, and politically, because his experience in Hiroshima led him to a belief that Japan's biggest issue was the nation's own inability collectively to wrestle in its own way with those left behind by the changes racking the country. He'd later tell the Paris Review that he felt he was a boring person because, quote, "I read a lot of literature, I talk about a lot of things, but at the base of it all is Hikari and Hiroshima." And that trajectory, Hikari and Hiroshima, would indeed carry much of Oe's career from this point on. After A Personal Matter, a novel about a father coming to grips with his own son's brain herniation, so pretty on the nose, he'd produce Manen Gannen no Futoboru, literally football in the year 1860, but known in English by the somewhat more poetic A Silent Cry. This, too, is a story about a man running from fatherhood, in this case a vegetative son, who ends up with his brother in their hometown in rural Shikoku. There he ends up reliving a story from his family's past, when two siblings found themselves on opposite ends of a peasant uprising in the final years of the shogunate. There's also Kaifukusuru Kazoku, or A Healing Family, a non-fiction work about the family's struggles with illustrations done by Oe Yukari, who is apparently a very talented artist in her own right. In terms of Hiroshima, meanwhile, Hiroshima Notes, based on his time in the city, came out in 1865, and the experience spurred an interest in those at the periphery of Japanese society. Okinawa Notes, written 5 years later on the occasion of the announcement that those islands would revert back to Japan from the US, grew out of similar concerns. Now, realistically, there's no way I could cover Oe's entire body of work. He published, by my count, 31 more books after A Personal Matter, not to mention countless interviews and shorter pieces. But I think this gives a good sense of his trajectory, concerned both with the emotional experiences that defined him and with the broader experiences that defined his generation. He'd later say he felt the ills of Japanese society stemmed from a sense of complacency, that after about 1870, the ferment of post-war Japan settled into a lazy materialist conformism that ignored the questions of what it meant to be a freer and more equal post-imperial society in favor of just getting rich, and which pushed those out of the mainstream to the side because of the awkward ways their very presence invited discussion on difficult topics. As he put it in one interview, quote, "The writer's task in Japan is to write down his words one by one, with the idea in his mind of a radical rearrangement of the unitary cultural paradigm in his own culture and elsewhere." And it was apparently that very radicalism that got the attention of the Nobel Committee, who awarded Oe the prize in literature in 1994 because he, quote, "with poetic force creates an imagined world where life and myth condense to form a disconcerting picture of the human predicament today. We don't know much about his nomination process because of the 50-year requirement around ballots for the prize being kept secret, so we won't really have a clear idea of how the nomination and voting went until 2044. However, we do know quite a bit about Oe's Nobel lecture. It's probably one of the most famous things he's ever written. Like so much of his work, it's about the predicaments of modern Japanese society. It's also a play on the speech given by Japan's only other Nobel laureate. Kawabata Yasunari's lecture in 1968 was entitled Utsukushi Nihon no Watashi, Japan the Beautiful and Myself, or more literally, Myself of Beautiful Japan. Oe's, in turn, is called Aimai na Nihon no Watashi, Japan, the Ambiguous, and Myself. Much of the essay, as you might imagine, is in direct reaction to Kawabata, whose view of Japan as beautiful Oe says he cannot share. I certainly don't think I can outright the man himself, so I'm just going to rely on his words here. Quote, "As someone living in the present and sharing bitter memories of the past imprinted on my mind, I cannot utter in unison with Kawabata the phrase, Japan the beautiful and myself. My observation is that after 120 years of modernization since the opening of the country, present-day Japan is split between two opposite poles of ambiguity. I, too, am living as a writer with this polarization imprinted upon me like a deep scar. This ambiguity, which is so powerful and penetrating that it splits both the state and its people, is evident in various ways. The modernization of Japan has been orientated towards learning from and imitating the West, yet Japan is situated in Asia and has firmly maintained its traditional culture. The ambiguous orientation of Japan drove the country into the position of an invader of Asia. What I call Japan's ambiguity in my lecture is a kind of chronic disease that has been prevalent throughout the modern age. Japan's economic prosperity is not free from it either, accompanied as it is by all kinds of potential dangers in the light of the structure of world economy and environmental conservation. The ambiguity in this respect seems to be accelerating. It may be more obvious to the critical eyes of the world at large than to us within the country. At the nadir of the post-war economic poverty, we found a resilience to endure it, never losing our hope for recovery. It may sound curious to say so, but we seem to have no less resilience to endure our anxiety about the ominous consequence of emerging out of the present prosperity. The antidote to all this ambiguity, this uncertainty about what Japan is, where it is going, what it means to be a part of it, he says, is art, drawing once again on the story of his son, for whom music was always a way forward to connection with others. Because art, he says, is all about humanity, both in the literal sense and in the idea of learning compassion and humaneness. It's a lovely speech, if a very intellectual one, and well worth a read, in my view. Oe's final work, In Late Style, was published in 2013. Towards the end of his life, he remained very active in politics. For example, in the 2000s, he was embroiled in a lawsuit with two former Imperial Japanese Army officers who accused him of defamation as a result of Okinawa notes. Specifically, they took issue with Oe's totally historically accurate claim that Japanese soldiers encouraged and sometimes forced the mass suicide of Okinawan civilians during the battle for the island in 1945. Oe would eventually win that lawsuit, though it proved to be a very draining experience for him. Oe would also remain an active member of the anti-nuclear movement in Japan, both in terms of disarmament and, after 3/11 and the Fukushima meltdown, arguing for the shutdown of the nation's nuclear reactors. Oe died just a few months ago, on March 3rd, 2023. In his final years, he was not quite the sensation he once was. He himself actually jokingly noted in an interview in the 90s that he was not even close to the biggest name in Japanese literature anymore, and that young up-and-comers like Murakami Haruki and Yoshimoto Banana were outselling his work by a large margin. Indeed, Oe's work did not sell that well after the 60s, ironically several decades before he got the nod for the Nobel Prize. Perhaps the cultural conversation left him behind, or perhaps an author who viewed the basic concerns of modern Japanese society as a myopic avoidance mechanism to get away with confronting the real issues of post-war society, was always going to have a hard time marketing himself. Despite not exactly being a chart topper, I do think Oe's work does what all literature at least in part aspires to do. It gets at an important part of that cultural conversation. Just as Kawabata Yasunari's work is all about notions of beauty and the uncomfortable politics that can sometimes underlie discussions of beauty in a Japanese context, Oe's really is all about ambiguity. It's about highlighting the contradictions of a freer Japan that gained that freedom from another country at gunpoint, or about a wealthier and more equal society which also continues to push people to the margins if they don't fit a predetermined image. More intimately, it's about the ambiguity of embracing or running from responsibilities and relationships when things get tough. These are, of course, deeply human concerns, but they're also very much the concerns of Oe's time and generation. Perhaps in the end, that's the best way to think about him, as someone who gave a voice to what it meant to grapple with the complexities of life in the new Japan. That's all for this week. Thank you very much for listening. This show is a part of the Facing Backward podcast network. You can find out more about the show and our other shows at facingbackward.com, and you can support the network at patreon.com/facingbackward. Special thanks to those who have given at our shout-out tier: Jan Leonard, Stephen Elkins, Martin Oliveira, Clark Canning, Ian Kellett, Matt Haynes, Jackie Frostocker, Monkey Sack, Alayla McCulloch, Karen Murphy, Peter Wales, Robert Prine, William Arno, Jonas Brandis, Nicholas Kroll, Jerry Spinrad, Jared Stevens, Jeffrey Dwork, Stefan Hruschka, Joshua Kane, Robian Cat, Jacob Key, Aaron Finkbeiner, an anonymous Anna's hummingbird, a house is a perfectly cromulent mascot, and the fish I catch are Rhodes Scholars, compared to Samuel Alito, schmuck. Special thanks also to new patron Andrew for donating to support the History of Japan Patreon. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next week for the start of a two-part series on one of the more fascinating figures of discussion of post-war Japanese history, the Indian jurist whose dissent against the Tokyo war crimes trials has made him a major figure of the Japanese right wing, Radhabinod Pal.